Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Governor Dennis Dugard gives his State of the State speech just a little after 1 p.m. Central, noon Mountain today. SDPB is there with coverage online on SDPB TV and on SDPB Radio. Stay tuned here. You can hear everything live. You can also download the app SDNet in your favorite app store and listen there. Now, our Keely Boltina is with South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and she is there in Pierre. She joins us live now with a preview. Keely, how are things looking out there in Pierre right now?
It is cold and it is fun.
It saves and it for you, doesn't it? Absolutely. Last time you went out there, that first thing was, how did you get there with the weather?
And right, exactly. That's how it always works. But no, the Capitol has lots and lots of people. It's always an exciting start to the session.
I saw your picture on Twitter. You can follow her at Keely SDPB. That's Keely with a K-E-A-L-E-Y. And everyone was lined up there, and I think there's some fresh haircuts.
I think so too.
That's true. Like really trimmed.
Everything is very pressed. Check back in about 8 or 9 weeks, and we'll go from there.
All right. So you've been kind of looking around and finding out what you can hear, your ears to the ground. Tell me what folks are saying about the State of the State coming up.
Well, we don't know a whole lot about the State of the State, but this is Governor Dugard's opportunity to maybe mention a couple of numbers. But the budget address in December is always heavy in the numbers, you know, hence the name budget address. This is his opportunity to talk about the things he sees for the state and what the state needs and the good and the bad. So we know from the governor's office, they've told me that you can watch at 1 o'clock Central for a lot of discussion about economic issues, some talk about financial management. He's also going to talk about the meth epidemic, and then he'll touch on some other topics, but really those finances, economy, and meth are going to be the main themes you'll hear from the governor today.
Many choices. Why do you think those are rising to the top for this particular speech?
You know, Governor Dugard started out his 8 years talking about the budget, dealing with major cuts, dealing with fiscal responsibility, and making sure that we don't have a structural deficit. So he's going back to that financial management. And he's also, recently talked more about doing so transparently and dealing with open government when different officials go about this sort of business for the people. So I anticipate hearing through some of that. And, you know, lawmakers are happy to hear a lot of that. I mean, when I've been talking to them, one of the things they mentioned is economic development. They want to hear more about that.
Who else have you been able to talk to? Does anyone really kind of open up before this, before the speech, or is it pretty tight-lipped and wait and hear what the governor has to say?
Oh, no, they have their own ideas. It's very clear when you come to Pierre that the legislature is separate from the executive branch, and they welcome what the governor has to say, and they certainly agree with him on many things, but each and every individual lawmaker has different priorities. So we talked about economic development, but I have a long list just from chatting with lawmakers today and saying, hey, what are the things you want to see this session? What are you going to work on? Some are looking into education as far as pre-kindergarten education and how that might work in South Dakota, because we have some schools and the districts just provide that free of charge to parents as part of public education. They want to see if that's fiscally appropriate statewide. They want to look at the formula for small schools, especially when it comes to declining enrollment. They talk about the meth epidemic, but then there's this whole section of healthcare where some people say, well, we have to do something because we don't know what's coming with the president in the next 4 years and the congressional attempt to repeal Obamacare. People say, hey, who knows what the Affordable Care Act repeal might bring, so we don't want to do anything. There was a big nursing home task force and looking at beds over the summer. So there are some bills that are coming out trying to figure out how to compensate hospitals for care, how to deal with a mismatch of beds and locations where residents want those in the communities, maybe selling beds or moving them within organizations. Different lawmakers say they want to make sure that they keep a balanced budget but still meet the needs of the public. One of them said that might be kind of difficult. And then I've also heard a lot about numerous efforts to adjust the process of initiated measure or constitutional amendments placed on the ballot. A lot of people are talking about that, specifically related to IM-22, which is a big overhaul, but in ethics and creates a commission and many, many different things. Governor Dugard took a lot of time in his budget address to talk about that. Lawmakers have been talking about that. And so not only are they looking at this particular measure, in talking about things like influences that come from outside of South Dakota as far as money and political access, but they're also looking at the process itself and making changes to one of the big things that South Dakota likes to tout, this idea that we have this initiated measure and referendum process that was the first in the nation. So they're looking to tweak that this session. So we'll have to see from how many vantage points that comes.
SDPB's Kaylee Beltina is there in Pierre. Also there, our political reporter Lee Strubinger. Stephanie Rissler is there. You can watch SDPB TV 1. The governor's State of the State speech will be all live on radio and TV and online. It starts right about 1 o'clock Central, noon Mountain. Kaylee, you've covered the legislature for a lot of years. I know you've got a lot of work, so we'll let you go. Thanks for stopping by today, though.
Thank you. Talk to you at 1.
And as the 2017 legislative session gets underway, we continue our conversations with incoming lawmakers. Today, we hear from Representative Tim Goodwin.
I'm in District 30, which encompasses Fall River County, which is where Hot Springs is the biggest city in, and Custer County, of course, where Custer is in Custer State Park. And then they took Pennington County, and it's a long, narrow county, and they cut it down the long, narrow way, going east and west. So it's Wall, outside of Rapid City, the southern part, Hill City up to Deerfield Lake. And so it's 110 miles by 80 miles. So it was a challenge running in that district, but it was a lot of fun.
I can imagine. And a beautiful place.
The most gorgeous place. I tease people when I talk that the District 30 residents should get some type of bonus from the state like they do in Alaska. Because everything that South Dakota uses to advertise itself with comes out of District 30. You know, Custer State Park, Mount Rushmore, the list goes on and on.
So you want to leverage that somehow?
Yeah.
Give me an idea of how you ended up deciding to run and sort of throw your hat into this ring. Give me some of your background.
Well, I retired from the military 20 years ago, and then I got into business and was in sales for 20 years. And so I got up to the over 60, and I did really well. And so I didn't need to work anymore. And I kind of got in some conservative groups in Rapid City. One of them is called the Wing Nuts, which is a real conservative Republican group. And kind of got caught up in their moment, was disappointed in the legislature and that it was turning from being a Republican and conservative group into more of a big spend, big government group, in my opinion. Started 2 years ago, and we've increased taxes $335 million in the last 2 years. And to me, that isn't conservatism. I would just like to back up and say that I'm a Christian conservative Republican, and I mean that in that order. I'm a Christian first, then I'm a conservative, then I'm a Republican. And so that's what I ran on, and it worked out really well.
How do you take those Christian values into peer? What does that mean for you personally?
Well, the Christian values is your moral ethics, you know, like absolute pro-life. I believe life begins at conception, no wavering in that at all. And then, you know, all the other Christian values, whichever one you want to talk about, I'd surely address it.
What comes to your mind? I guess I'm wondering. There's
this is why I look at it. This is my take on it. You know, everything has a reference. So being a Christian, my reference is the Bible. Being a conservative, it's the Constitution. And being a Republican, it's the Republican platform.
So give me an idea when you say sort of things have gone in a direction that maybe pulls away from those traditional conservative values beyond the Christian. Let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned taxes. Anything else that jumps to your mind that sort of has been a turn down path you'd like to see us bring back?
Yeah, we had a situation where the South Dakota Athletic Association passed that if you're a one-gender person and you want to play in the another gender's person sports team, a man or a boy, in high school wants to be on the girls' basketball team, they can do that. And they also said if they do that, they have to use that facility, that locker room or that bathroom. And so the legislator last year, I wasn't there, obviously, but I played close attention and went over there a couple days in Pierre. And so it was passed in the House, two dissenting votes. I think there was two people absent, so that would be, 66-2? And the governor vetoed it. The way it is today, a male student, because I think a male would probably be more likely to do it, can play on the female student's team, volleyball or basketball or what have you, and be able to go into their locker room. And that's crazy, absolutely crazy.
So obviously, North Carolina passed a sort of transgender bathroom legislation that was recently readdressed because of the economic impact that it had on the state. Being from District 30, that economic impact is also very real for you. What are your thoughts there as far as legislation impacting your district?
It's a great question. The Family Heritage Alliance actually addressed it, and it wasn't like we were being prejudiced to any group. If somebody, what they had was the bill that said that if somebody is of a transgender nature, that they don't use the opposite sex bathroom or locker room, the school provides an alternate facility, for example, the coach's locker room.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a compromise, and it wasn't to isolate anybody or to judge anybody else. It was to make it so that you don't have a high school senior boy in the girls' locker room.
Do you think a compromise such as the one that you just mentioned in South Dakota is going to sort of satisfy the different sides of the issue and prevent the...
I would hope it would. You know, it's the minority that kind of always wins in these deals. I know the majority feel that way. And it was a very fair bill, I felt, and it got vetoed. So it's going to come back again this year.
Would you say that's a priority for you this year, or are there other priorities that you're really looking forward to pursuing in Pierre?
That would be one of the things you know, I'm a freshman legislature. I have went to Pierre twice, once for we had to do voting the leadership. Another time we went to the governor's address and stayed for orientation.
Yeah.
And so I got my committee assignments from the Speaker of the House, Speaker Mickelson, and I'm on taxation and on transportation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have some taxation issues that I'd like to repeal some taxes and make them more fair. And then, of course, transportation, that's a big one.
Hmm.
You know, that's our state is transportation.
All right. Give me some ideas.
There's been some tax. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, give me some ideas of how transportation is, we might see that unfold in 2017.
Well, there's a couple of things that are on the transportation that happened in Senate Bill 1, which was passed 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And in Senate Bill 1, they passed a bill where if you want to get the bridge funds from the state of South Dakota, the county has to pass a wheel tax. So the state is telling the county they have to pass an additional tax, which I think is wrong. It's strong-arming.
Mm-hmm.
And so in Pennington County, which is part of my district, they passed it, and then they had a referendum on it and got it stopped. But therefore, Pennington County can't get any of the bridge money from the state to fix their bridges with, which the money was collected here. So it's a strong-arm tactic that I don't think the state should be able to do that.
Sure. Initiated Measure 22 has caused a lot of conversation back and forth. IM 22, which was about you know, anti-corruption and ethics. How was that? Have you seen any impact as a new lawmaker? What has your experience with that been? Tell me about that.
Well, first off, Initiated 22, and I'm new, like I said, but I don't know how somebody can take a 14,000-word initiative that takes an hour and a half to read out loud and reduce it down to 6 inches on the ballot, like 190 words.
Mm-hmm.
So the quality control there questions me. I don't think the people knew what they were voting for. And then, of course, you have the outside money coming from outside the state, most of it from Massachusetts, that you know, I did a commercial on TV where the guy's putting money underneath the table to a legislature. And, of course, that was supposed to stop secret, underhanded giving, which you can never legislate secrets. There's going to be secrets at the end of time. It's the ethics of the person. But what IM-22 did, it said that you can only have, for example, $100 in gifts on an annual basis.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all kinds of socials and stuff that you go to meet your constituents and the different lobbying groups that we got invited to. I bet I had 20 or 30, probably closer to 30, that I didn't go to because you only can have $100 worth of stuff of giving to you. My mate, Julie Fry, she went to one at the School of Mines when she had a three hors d'oeuvre, she said, and she walked out the door there and handed a voucher for $42. So I teased her that she's got $58 left. And so that's what's going on with it. But we're damned if we do and damned if we don't on that one, because it's passed as an anti-corruption bill. So if we overturn it, it's going to look like we're corrupt,
mm-hmm.
which, and then if you want to get into the democracy credits on it, if I explained it to you, you'd think I was making it up.
Well, let's just stay on the ethics a little bit. What do you think? Obviously, the voters voted for it. They had an intention. What do you think the voters' intention was in passing IM-22?
Well,
and
I think there was a conception that there was underhanded ethics that are going on. But in the back of their mind, too, if you talk to the voters, and I've, you know, worked really hard on my campaign, as you know, you have two different situations that are really unfortunate for our state. One's EB-5, and mm-hmm. another one's GEAR-UP. which there was all types of ethics problems there. There's people that actually committed suicide or and what have you. And so, you know, that's in the back of everybody's mind. How could something as tragic as Europe and EB5 happen to a great state like South Dakota?
How do we address that then? If the voter's intention is to sort of prevent those large-scale scandals, is there a way that...
Yeah, it has nothing to do with IM-22. Yeah, you're right.
But how do we address it then?
You know, the Attorney General's on both of them. They're still open. He's still investigating on both of those. So, I mean, we got to leave it to him and let him handle it. But, you know, I'm really... I told you when you asked about IM-22, we're damned if we do and damned if we don't. There's a lot of things that the democracy credits on that make no sense at all. Mm-hmm. I can address that if you want.
Yeah, just go ahead for a few minutes. What are your thoughts on those democracy credits?
Well, the democracy credits are in there where you get up to $12 million. Each voter gets two $50 democracy credits.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what a candidate has to go get, though. So you go knocking doors to your district, and you ask if you can have their democracy credits. The husband gets, if it's a two-party house, you know, the wife gets one and, or gets two, and then the husband gets two. And if they give you, say they gave you, each gave you $50 worth, so you got 100. And then there's some way you correspond with peer, and then you get coupons for it. And say, I got enough democracy credits up to $500, and I could go to the Cruster Chronicle and show them that I got $500 worth of democracy credits. And then they send it into the state, and they get paid the $500. Now, I don't know how many full-time people it's going to take to administer this program, but every full-time state employee is about $80,000 with benefits and a retirement, what have you. And so the other thing that's really flawed in it, it says it caps out at $12 million. Well, if you add up all the voters and it takes, in the state, it takes $60 million. Well, it'd be unfair just to let some people get democracy credits and other people not. And the way I understand it, and I have a layman's understanding of it, is that you can't use any of your own money. You have to, the only way you can use for radio advertising, newspaper ads, what have you, is through these democracy credits.
How would this have changed if this had been in effect when you were running as a new lawmaker? How would it have changed your campaign process?
I probably wouldn't have ran because I don't know. It would have been a, not having any name recognition or anything and having to go knock doors and beg. I'm not a very good groveling, begging person, you know. I've been successful in life. I don't need to go ask people to fund me.
You have a background in sales, though.
I do. Yeah. I mean, I could go do it, but I feel if I'm going to run, I'll self-fund my campaign. If somebody gives me money, I'm not going to turn it down so one hurts their feelings. But I'll self-fund my campaign, and I don't need to go grovel at doors for money. That's just my opinion. That's not any official Republican opinion or conservative opinion.
Sure.
But I'm not going to, you know, the democracy credits would be a free fall. I mean, it's like... It's beyond how you, I don't know how you would do it.
Are you looking forward to sorting that out, or are you kind of getting a headache even thinking about going to peer with that sort of hanging over?
I'm kind of thinking they're going to, whatever you do, they're going to use for you or against you. And I'm thinking, if I vote, if we bring it up and it comes down to a vote, if we're going to throw it out or not, if I vote to throw it out, then they're going to say I'm for corruption. And if I vote the other way, it really is a bad bill. So maybe there's a way we can rewrite it or what way we could get it where it's fair.
That's Tim Goodwin from District 30. We talked with him as part of our series with South Dakota incoming freshman lawmakers, and we did talk to him before the injunction on initiated Measure 22 as well. We heard from Susan Wismer last hour. We've got rancher Steve Livermont later in the hour, all on their way to Pier, or probably already there right now. After the break, USF head football coach John Anderson talks with Chris Lawfrey. Stay in the moment, SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. John Anderson is in his first season as head football coach at the University of Sioux Falls. He was introduced as the university's 21st head coach. In the Moment's producer, Chris Lawfrey, begins this piece by asking Coach Anderson about the program itself.
Well, it's a program that has tremendous tradition, dating back a long time ago. We've successfully put together 23 consecutive winning seasons, which is a great number. I was a part of 11 of those in my previous time here, so I got a lot of pride in that. And it's the football program's a part of the university, and it's a great Christian education. And we look for guys that want to come in and be a part of that tradition and get a great degree.
Tell us about how you went about selecting the members of your coaching staff.
Looking for coaches that can fit in and understand the culture here at USF. It's something pretty special to me, and wanted great leaders of men, guys that put their faith out there in their coaching and in their teaching, and be able to live that daily. And then also looking for great recruiters, guys that are personable, can relate to young people, and also relate to parents and grandparents, because it's a family decision for these recruits, and couldn't feel better about the staff that we have in place.
Coach, you just alluded to a 10-year run with USF from 2002 until 2012. What was your coaching role then?
I was at different times. I was a linebacker coach the entire time, but I was a special teams coordinator for a time and also a defensive coordinator.
For the last four seasons, you were the head coach at West Virginia State. Do you have plans of bringing part of that program back to USF, or are you going to start fresh?
I have several coaches that I've worked with from that staff, guys that do all the great things that I just mentioned, and they're in the process of recruiting for this university and for this team and relocating their lives. And the things that I intend to bring there is just experience of being a head coach, experience of being at a different institution and learning and being able to bring those experiences to USF.
Now, reading up on your career, it appears to me as though you're heavily involved in the community in which you serve. Will that continue now that you're back in Sioux Falls?
Absolutely, and that's a critical pillar of our program. I think it serves our young people well to be able to go out and give back, and being able to be a gifted athlete is one thing, but being able to give back to other people in need is an entirely thing, or another thing altogether. So we'll be looking for opportunities to get involved, and I know this team has been involved as well, and be able to get our athletes out there interacting with the community. It's an important part.
Now, you're fortunate enough to have 12 starters returning. How instrumental are they going to be this fall?
Well, everybody on this team is going to be instrumental. We're coming into a team that was Northern Sun champions in 2016 and Division II playoff participant. And, we need to get to know these players, all of them, and get to build strong relationships with them and let them know that the expectations are going to remain in place. The process will be similar. But getting to know all those guys is our number one role right now.
What are your personal recruiting plans now that you're in the position that you are?
To find the best and brightest academic guys and athletes that South Dakota and the region has to offer, and let them know the tremendous education that the University of Sioux Falls provides, and let them know that we have a tremendous football program as well.
Does that process start locally, like you just alluded to, and then get branched out nationally, or how does that work?
Well, we will definitely recruit. We're sitting in Sioux Falls, which has arguably some of the best football in the state, and we need to keep the best from the city here at home, and also from our home state. And then there's some great recruiting areas that are regional for us. Northwest Iowa has been a long held traditional place that we've gotten players out of, obviously Minnesota and the Twin Cities and into Nebraska, great athletes there regionally, into Wisconsin and into Denver, where Sioux Falls is traditionally recruited, are going to be we're going to maintain those relationships and work to get the best student athletes out of those areas we can.
Now, Coach, you're no stranger to South Dakota. You spent a season at Dakota State University, which is in Madison, like we talked about before, 10 years at USF. What, if anything, will you bring back to USF from your time at Dakota State?
That seems like a long time ago, but that was an introduction to me to South Dakota, and point in my career as a young coach where I was doing a little bit of everything there. I was a special teams coordinator and football coach. I was a assistant track coach. I was a dorm director and did a little bit of everything. So as a head coach, that's kind of what the role is too, to do a little bit of everything that needs to be done. So that was just a learning period in my career, and we have fond memories of our time in Madison.
All right, Coach. Lastly, if you had a crystal ball and you're looking into it, what would you see as far as the future of the University of Sioux Falls football program is concerned?
Our future is going to be no different than what this team has always done. And championships are the expectation, but we're not going to focus on that. We're going to focus on being better tomorrow than we were today. And whatever the process that we have to do to get our young people to buy into that, we will. And this is a great group. They understand how to win. They understand what it takes. And they're great students and great people. So we're going to work with, we've got so many advantages with those things in place that we're going to work, just being better tomorrow than we were today.
John Anderson, head coach, University of Sioux Falls football. Thanks for your time. Good luck.
All right. Thank you very much.
That's Chris Lawfrey talking with John Anderson, University of Sioux Falls. We continue now to meet the incoming freshman class of the 2017 legislature. Here is rancher Steve Livermont from District 27.
Never been in before. I'm 61 years old and just taking a run at her.
Give us an idea of what sort of compelled you to take this on at the age of 61 at this particular time in South Dakota history and in your own personal life.
Well, I've become very concerned with the way the country was going. Mm-hmm. Between our national debt and some of the mandates that have been pushed through from the federal level and the state level onto our local communities, and we're spending a record amount of money at the federal level and in terrible debt. I don't know how we're going to pull ourselves out of it, but at the same time, at the local level, we're being strapped for funds and seems like we're getting more and more regulations coming down the tube, and at the same time that we're paying more taxes, and there's seem like the governments are always trying to find more ways to tax us more. And I just wanted to step up and, when I'm 80 years old, say that at least I tried something.
Yeah.
To straighten it out.
What are some of your priorities then going into the next session? What are some of the topics you're sort of most looking forward to, sort of sinking into and figuring out?
Probably trying to curb the state government and try to make them become more thrifty to where they, aren't just demanding more money all the time and each department's wanting more money and just putting a halt on that. I've got no really true agenda.
Mm-hmm.
There's just trying to bring, my own frugal ways to the government if I can, so that the people out here aren't just getting hammered with more taxes all the time.
Were you able to make it to the orientation and the governor's budget address then?
Yes, I did.
What were some of your thoughts about that early thoughts of the governor's budget and in relation to your notions of thrift and a smaller government that spends less?
I think it's just a typical deal where they're still looking for more revenue. At the same time that they've got all these ideas about where they're going to use all this money, but at the same time they're also looking for more revenue.
Mm.
And they don't. One of the things that was most apparent to me was the lack of revenue because of the egg market, and we're seeing that probably the worst dip in income in the last 5 years out in the ag community that uh, we've ever seen. I mean, we went to record high prices, but we've also come back to a record lows in accordance with parity, you know, where our expenses go up every time you turn around, all of our inputs go up, but you know, everything else, taxes and expenses are just keep rising.
So what's your professional background then?
I'm a rancher, always have been.
I'm wondering, your experience as a rancher, how do you think you can bring that to peer and really apply it to solving problems?
I think, you know, one of the things that that we learn out here is that your income is never the same every year. It either goes up or it goes down, and you look at what your income is, and you know, if it goes way down, you're just going to have to tighten your belts. And the other thing is saving for a rainy day. I hear a lot of instances where you got budgets that are proposed to different segments of the government, and rather than allow them to, say, a department to build up a savings, there's the tendency to spend everything in their budget so that their budget isn't cut for the next year. I've got a lot to learn. It's going to be a tough learning curve, but I'm always up for new challenges like this.
What are you looking forward to the most about this upcoming session? What are you most excited about or curious about?
Well, when I finally get over the top and I kind of understand how things are done, and maybe I can find some solutions to some of the problems that I see.
Yeah, a fresh set of eyes on some long-term...
Thinking out of the box, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we look forward to checking back with you and sort of learning along with you as far as how things in peer work and some of your impressions during the session as well.
We'll see what we can get done. I look forward to every day, I guess.
Yeah. Steve, thank you so much for joining us today and taking the time.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Representative Steve Livermont from District 27 as part of our ongoing conversations with the South Dakota freshman class of lawmakers for 2017. When we come back, SDPB contributor Hugh Weber is with us again. He brings you more from the Potluck Society after the break. You're in the moment, SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. The work of running a city is often limited to elected officials and city administrators. Arts and culture can be pushed to the periphery of planning, development, and city design. But sometimes an artist sees that the city and its people can be a canvas all its own. SDPB contributor and the Potluck Society host, Hugh Weber, is back with another ordinary person building extraordinary community. Hugh, welcome back to In the Moment.
Well, thanks for having me, Laurie. We've got a great virtual hot dish for you today. So, I've been working with Gary on my potluck puns.
Oh, boy. So. Well, okay. So who are we going to meet today?
We're going to meet Zach DeBoer. Zach is a native of Brandon, South Dakota. But if you spend any time with him at all, you'd be excused for assuming that he's just a transplant from Minneapolis or Chicago or somewhere further away. He has this incredible sense of what community is and what a city can be. I've come into collision with Zach many times over the past couple of years, and each conversation is an adventure all its own. We might talk about the best practices of parking spaces or art mazes, building codes, or how to curate a city like an art gallery. Last week, we talked for nearly 2 hours, but today I want to share just a little bit of that conversation with you, so let's jump in.
My name is Zach DeBoer. I am the owner of Exposure Gallery and Studios, located in downtown Sioux Falls. We are a contemporary art gallery and studio space for artists, but we also do a lot of projects in the community with a focus on urban design and city involvement.
You live at this interesting intersection of community development and art or art engagement or creative engagement. And I'm curious to hear kind of how you describe your work. And do you find yourself on one side or the other? Are you an artist? Are you in community development? And what does all that mean? And why is it? Why are those things important to each other? How do they inform each other?
That's a good question. I'm kind of new to like this, and I think I guess whatever this is somewhat new in general. I think versions of being an artist, or in terms of being an artist concerned with community or interested in how design or contemporary ideas can affect a community, isn't necessarily a new thing, but I think that there's more and more interest in that area, or there's a lot more interest in cities. I see myself as an artist primarily, or at least an artist first, because I think that is the unique way in which I approach a lot of the issues or projects that I tackle, is through the lens of an artist. But I guess I am fascinated with the way a city works, or how a city could work, and how things like design or things like art can affect and improve a city. A lot of times art is that kind of line item in a city budget that's first to be cut. You know, the same thing goes with schools. But unlike schools, it feels like art in the city, or art's involvement with the city, is starting to be noticed or starting to be accepted as a viable economic tool or development tool, beyond just quality of life for the people, you know, coming downtown or living downtown. And so I see my role, or what my job is, that I just kind of look at what the city's doing. I try to involve myself in any project they might be doing, whether that's, you know, a parking ramp or a park, or, you know, design standards, anything that can be looked at further, or that could involve art, or, you know, I'll say more contemporary urban design. And the urban design facet of this is kind of what drew me in and started kind of make those parallels between urban design and art and city, and that all started to blend together. So
why does that stuff matter? Why does it matter to you specifically?
Design affects everybody. I mean, it sounds like foofy extra stuff to put money into beautifying or designing a place in a certain way, but these are the things that people care about, whether they can audibly say that or not. We know through studies, and, you know, cities have been around for a little while, and we've seen that that's where people go. They're attracted to art. They're attracted to these beautiful things. They're attracted to how a road that is 12 feet wide scares them away, but a road that is 9 feet wide welcomes them in, and they feel safe, and they want to walk on those streets, and they want to shop at those stores. I just became fascinated with how what something simple or seemingly not important can completely change an area. And I'm obsessed with using existing resources to the best of their ability. I've started to kind of see this kind of through line through some of the stuff that I do, or just, you know, my own behavior in life. I like taking what exists already and figuring out how I can combine them or put them together or tweak them just a little bit to make them work. And so I see good city design is that. It's this constant like tweaking and seeing how we can, you know, be clever and use our existing resources and just change them a little bit and reactivate a street, you know, utilize a park better, utilize a building better, use it in a different way. I think, you know, cities are always changing, are always evolving, are always refining, and usually good design is the tool in which we, you know, refine these places.
I love how he looks and points to these existing resources. I think so often this region and the communities in this region are defined by scarcity or what they lack. And I think Zach sees the world in this sort of abundant way, which I think is beautiful beyond the art that he's creating. last year he was an ODA builder, which was a micro fellowship grant program for creatives and community builders. And he had the opportunity to speak on stage at ODA Bismarck. At the time, I remember the one quote that he shared, and in saying that instead of a canvas, he had a street. Instead of paint, he had people. And I just thought, whoa, like this is big thinking. And so in our conversation, we talked a great deal about his art degree and his work. Was this practical enough for South Dakota? Is it useful to the community engagement work he does today? How do these things connect?
I think when you're growing up and when you're in school, and a lot of people's interpretation of, you know, if you get an art degree, you have a certain path or there's only a certain thing you can do with it. And I think to some degree that is true. But I think people need to view it like someone views a business degree, where it's more of a generic kind of, you know, degree where you can now use those tools that you learned in school and apply them to whatever avenue you want. And I think for the longest time, or a lot of people see when they get their art degree, they're like, well, I'm going to be an artist. Hopefully I can find some grants and some residencies and I can sell artwork, or, you know, I could teach. And, you know, those were kind of mostly the paths, but I'm seeing more and more people, and myself included, seeing how you can use your art degree and apply that to other areas. You know, I don't want to feel limited by the degree I picked, and I don't believe that I am. I believe that the degree and the background and the interest that I have in art is applicable to any avenue I want. It's just a matter of how do I use it? How do I use those creative problem-solving tools that I learned to other areas?
And do you feel like that comes in directly on things like the parking project? Or, I mean, it seems so linear when I think about the art maze and those type of efforts, but how does that creative side come in when it's the Visual Arts Commission, or it's the working with city government around parking spots? I mean,
I think what I've slowly realized is my what I'm good at is creative problem solving, is looking at an issue and looking at it both from, like, as you know, if we're talking about like parking, I'm looking at it from a physical spatial relationship. You know, I'm a gallery curator. I like to move things around until they're aesthetically pleasing. I want to be able to move people through my gallery in a way that complements the art and also complements, you know, them moving around. And so when I look at city problems, I think I look at it in that same kind of critical eye or analytical eye where, you know, I look, okay, if we scoot this up, if we move this back, if we push this forward, this area feels dead. We need something here, you know, to make this person walk from here to over here. We need something. And so I think I look at, you know, problems that same way, you know, breaking down those elements and really understanding what the solution could be, or how do we use what we have and twist things around and shift things to make them work. That's what I like to do. You know, anytime there's, you know, something like a bike lane, or the city says they're going to redesign a street, I immediately am looking for problems and looking for issues and looking for ways that, you know, we could tweak that, we could change that, we could add art here, we could add color here, we could do these sorts of things. And so I think that's where I'm kind of coming from with a lot of these, maybe not obvious art projects like painting parking lines.
Do you remember what the first spark was in that civic side of things and that community development thing, where you were like, this is something that I'm curious or interested about, or curious about how I might help solve a problem? Was there something that was kind of the jumping off point for that?
You know, I don't know that there's one single thing. You know, it was something that, as you know, as I get further into these things, I start to really think about the origins of where my interest in these sort of things come from. And, you know, in college, I think it was really in college that I really started to be interested in, I guess, either urban design or planning or how art can be integrated, or how a downtown can be activated. I was part of a short-lived committee with the college's dean that had kind of gathered people from the fine arts department. And we talked a little bit about our school's involvement with downtown and the city and how there wasn't really a connect. And I started to really become interested in, you know, can we fill this empty building with a gallery, or can we, you know, how do we get freshmen to go visit downtown instead of Burger King? And that started to become really fascinating to me. When I got done with college, the city started working on the downtown 2025 plan, which is their kind of 10-year envisioning kind of action plans. And I was involved in that process. And I really, once I got involved with downtown, that's when things started to kind of connect and click. And I saw that art's role was there, but maybe being underserved, that there wasn't, art wasn't part of that conversation as much as it should have been. And so I just started showing up to more and more things and saw that, I started, I guess, understand the importance of it and how problems could be solved through this, but they weren't being solved through that. And so I that's where my interest was that it felt like there was a, it felt like there was this old dusty chair that was labeled art, and it was always there, you know, and you could pull that chair up to the table, up to the discussion on any topic with the city or the state or just, you know, a neighborhood, and all I had to do was just go sit in it, because there wasn't, it wasn't really part of that conversation as much. You know, that's not to say there weren't art leaders who were pushing some of those things, or there weren't, you know, members of the city who were interested in having art being involved, but I think that it was more of a passive involvement. Yeah. And now I'm trying to make sure that it's an active part, and it's always one of the first things considered.
So there's just so much here, and we're going to unpack a lot of this on the Potluck Society podcast when we launch in a couple weeks. But the thing I keep coming back to is that though there's artistic whimsy, there's also this intense sense of purpose, that he's truly hopeful about his city and your city and cities of any size. At that talk in Bismarck, he asked, what does a park look like when it's designed by a dentist? What does a hairstylist do to approach homelessness? And as we start this new year, this idea that we all have a voice and that, you know, we can be optimistic about our cities and our shared future is pretty reassuring. So thank you for letting me share him, and we'll see you again here in the coming weeks, Lori.
Hugh Weber is the host of the new podcast, The Potluck Society. Hugh, I want to say thanks for introducing us to Zach. When can we download the Potluck Society podcast and listen to the full conversation?
We are 2 weeks away from launch.
Excellent.
Go to thepotlucksociety.com and sign up to make sure you get an early alert. But we'll be shouting it from the mountaintop soon.
Hugh, we'll see you next week with more.
Have a great week.